Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker, and I'm coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. This is Medical Whistleblower, and today we are very privileged to have Roger Kaiser here with us today to speak to us about the White House Boys, a grassroots organization, a democratic movement for justice, and one in which he has spent a great deal of patience and diligence to bring to light one of the worst records for juvenile care that ever existed in regards to the state of Florida. There was great negligence on the part of the Department of Juvenile Justice, and unfortunately this continues even to this day. Underfunded, poorly trained and screened staff, overcrowding and lack of progressive care, treatment, and skill has caused many a child in state care to have a bad experience. And one of those facilities existed in Marianna, Florida, of which our guest is very knowledgeable about and knows a great deal about the personal stories of the children who experienced child abuse in that facility. Are you there, Roger?
Yes, glad to be here today.
Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about how you came to know about the White House abuse?
Yes, I was actually raised from 3 years old to around 12. 12 and a half in the Children's Home Society in Jacksonville, Florida. It was not a very good life. A lot of abuse happened there. When I was 12, I started running away from the orphanage. And after about probably 20 or 30 times, the juvenile judge, Judge Marion Gooding, decided to send me to the Florida School for Boys at Marianna. It didn't bother me too much because I was already institutionalized. So when I drove up there, the police took us up there in a car, myself, a friend of mine, David Hutchins, also from the orphanage. And when we went in, this looked like we were driving into a college campus. There was manicured lawns and the buildings were just, you know, great. And there was a swimming pool and a gymnasium and a football field. I thought, well, this is great. I'm glad he sent me here. Well, little did I know that I was jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. And almost immediately, within hours, I could see that the treatment of the boys, the way they were being talked to, was just terrible. And over the next few weeks, I saw what would actually happen to the boys for almost anything. If you stepped off the sidewalk, if you did anything like that, if you stopped along the road on the way to work and got a strawberry, or a blackberry, I'm sorry, you would immediately go to Mr. Haddon's office and be taken down to a white concrete building that was known as the White House. Well, I heard that the beatings were pretty severe there. It's raining pretty hard here, so I don't know if you can pick up that rain or not. It's getting good. And as we would go to the lunch hall, the White House was right next to the dining area. And we would see boys being taken out of there that were bloody. We would see boys coming out of there in wheelbarrows. They looked as though they were dead. And I guess it took about probably 2 or 3 months before I was at the swimming pool, and I slipped on the swimming pool, and I said the S word, which I shouldn't have said. And the next thing you know, later that afternoon, I was taken to the White House. And when you walk in, it's sort of like, the only way you can describe it is almost like going into a dungeon deep down in a castle. You almost have to gasp for air. It's so moldy. It's a concrete and steel building. And they take you in, and there's a bunch of rooms there. But there's two small rooms, which are probably not much bigger than a prison cell. I'd say they're probably maybe 6 foot by 8 foot. And there's a little cot in there with a mattress on it, with a pillow. And the pillow, of course, generally was bloody, and the mattress was bloody. In some cases, you could go in there, and there would actually be pieces of lip and pillow where boys had actually bitten part of their tongue off during the beating. And so I took my beating until I finally passed out. I actually fought some. There was blood all over the place. And when I came back out, I was sent over to Mr. Curry's office, which was the school psychologist. And when I walked in, the secretary didn't even know who I was. I was so bloody. And I was finally sent back to Mr. Hatton's office, where I originally went from to the White House. And when I was standing in there, again, I'm 12 years old, and I couldn't sit down because my underwear had been beaten into my buttocks. And he said, "You sit down." And I said, "Well, I can't sit down. I need to go to the bathroom." And he said, "Well, get in there and use it. Get back over here. Make it quick." And when I turned around, I said the words, "One day I'm going to come back here, and I'm going to tell about what you people are doing here." And he jumped up out of his chair, and he pointed at me, and he said, "That's a good way to wake up dead tomorrow morning, sonny boy." Well, it was almost 54 years later when I came back. I wrote the book, The White House Boys, an American Tragedy. And the men who had undergone these beatings, several of them are millionaires. Two had run for governor of their state. There was a couple of military people. One in particular was Bryant Middleton, who was an Army captain, a ranger. And they all came forward. And then, of course, the media got hold of this. And the state, of course, we filed a petition with the Attorney General in Florida to investigate this because we knew that a lot of boys were killed. So we actually met them for a closing of the White House ceremony. This took about a year to get this done. I've been working on it for 17 years. And we all met up there, and they closed the White House. We put a plaque on it that it never, boys would never be beaten again. We planted a tree out there, and then we took them over to a graveyard, which had some 30-something graves out in the woods. And so that's when the story basically broke, and we knew that there were still some 50 boys buried around the campus that were, you know, were unaccounted for. And we tried to hunt them down. They say that they just were dismissed from the school and never showed up. But we have 52 or 53 boys who have no criminal record. They have no military record. They have no Social Security card. There is no record of these boys at all. So there's still some 52 or 53 boys that are still missing. And so we're still working on that even today. But this is just one of the most terrible experiences of my life.
Now, they did find there were 36. One unmarked grave, but there are many other graves that were found as well. And
yeah,
the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was eventually asked to investigate the 31 graves, but they didn't fully investigate all the possible places where bodies may have been buried, right?
Yeah, that's true. There's actually two other graveyards besides that one. But they didn't investigate those. And what they did is they came up with a list of the people and a peacock and a dog that were buried out there in that graveyard. Well, what we told them was not that these people weren't buried there. What we told them is we had stories of men who had come forward who actually helped put some of the bodies in the garbage cans, and they went out to this graveyard, and they actually dug up the graves are down 6 feet. They actually dug down like three and a half, 4 feet, put the garbage cans with the bodies in there, and then cover them back up. But the state of Florida refused to let us go in with ground-penetrating radar to see exactly where these bodies were. And, of course, now the school has been, we forced them to change the name of the school because Arthur G. Dozier was one of the worst abusers there was. And then finally, after another year, we got the school closed, partly because of what we had done and partly because of budget cuts in the state of Florida. So right now, it's totally sealed up. Nobody can go in there. They won't let anybody go in, including us, to find these other bodies.
So we essentially have children who were, like many like yourself, were court-ordered into this facility. And this facility was run for 109 years. And this facility was supposedly run by the state of Florida. State of Florida was running it, funding it. The staff were apparently receiving their paychecks from state funds. And yet,
yes,
horrible abuse happened to children there. Certainly brutal beatings of children. way beyond what would be considered a normal disciplinary action. I mean, way in excess of that. Cruel and unusual treatment and punishment. And then also degrading treatment, sometimes sexual degradation. And we have heard also that children were also sexually abused there, right?
Yes, that's true. They had a room underneath the administration building they called the rape room, and there was a number of men taken there. The one thing I want to make clear, now, when we say the state of Florida ran this institution, they did, but it wasn't actually any type of a juvenile justice department of Florida, because that wasn't even thought of back then. It was actually ran by the Florida Department of Agriculture, because it was a big farm. And there was like 600 boys there, and the boys actually worked to keep the facility open. And so you had like a slaughterhouse, you know, beef farm, a pork farm. You grew hundreds and hundreds of acres of peanuts and corn and all this stuff. And this was one of the reasons that this was never exposed. It wasn't so much because anybody in Jackson County or Mariana wanted the boys to be beaten or molested. The problem is that these pit bosses that were over the various crews were actually selling the corn or the peanuts or the beef or the pork or eggs, chicken, whatever, to the merchants downtown. And, of course, the police were involved in this, as was the mayor and everybody else. And so there was millions of dollars worth of food and product used to support that school being siphoned off. So it ran into the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars over a period of years. Another thing that I need to make clear, when people listen to me talk about this, they need to understand that the children back in the 1950s weren't like the teenagers or the juvenile delinquents of today, the ones who are carjacking and killing, raping, pillaging, whatever. This was back when Elvis Presley first came out, and of course, the adults didn't like his rock and roll music. So anybody that would smoke a cigarette or comb their hair back into a DA or not go to school or skip school or run away, they were up-and-coming criminals, and Judge Gooding's statement puts it pretty well, and they say, these are nothing but up-and-coming criminals, and so we're going to send them off to the reform school, and we're not going to have any of this rock and roll nonsense. So again, most of the kids sent there, out of 600, I would say 550 of them were there for running away, for smoking cigarettes, skipping school, things like that. That was a pretty serious crime back then. And so
when these children were beaten within the school, it was for minor infractions as well. Would you not say not making your bed, picking a strawberry? It isn't like the infraction that made the children be beaten was a major infraction.
No, well, now what happened was, today, if you went by the facility today, there's two big, probably 18-foot fences with razor wire on it. Well, it wasn't like that back then. There weren't any fences. And so the spankings were only supposed to be used back then for boys who ran away. However, before they started these beatings years back, the runaway rate was, I'll just make something up, say 30 or 40 a month out of 600. Well, after they started the beatings, it turned to one or two a month. And so that worked so well, they said, well, okay, if we catch any of these boys smoking cigarettes, we're going to beat them. And then after that seemed to work a little bit, then it got to, if anybody curses, we're going to beat them. And it just kept building. And so pretty soon, if you even looked at, if you were smiling and an instructor came up or a pit boss says, what are you smiling about? Nothing, sir. You could go to the White House and be beaten. They started beating you for anything and everything. It was just terrible. And I guess my own self, as well as a bunch of the other men who experienced this as children, the worst thing wasn't so much the beating. It was the fear from the time you heard you were going. They may wait a day, they may wait an hour, they may wait till Saturday morning. That fear that you felt that you were going to the White House, between the time you heard it and the time you went to Hatton's office and the time you went to the White House, was the most horrible thing there ever was, because you didn't know if you were going to be beaten to death because you'd already seen boys beaten to death. You've seen, like I said before, we've seen boys that come out of there, especially black boys from the black side, because we were segregated at that time, and you'd see a couple of them in wheelbarrows, their head bent over the side of the wheelbarrow, their tongue hanging out. They weren't moving at all. They were dead. And so that's what we never got over, and that's what we fight for today, is to stop that. I mean, the beatings healed up.
Now, these boys, some of them were asked to hold other boys down while they received their beatings, even after the first boy had themselves been beaten, and they were afraid to say they wouldn't do it for fear of being beaten again. Is that not true?
That's true. And now, generally, once a boy was beaten, and if another boy tried to get up, they generally wouldn't use a boy who had just been beaten. The dining hall was right next door, so they'd go get a couple of these big guys who worked in the kitchen to hold you down. And what's really strange is when we had our first reunion back here in 2007 or 2008, a couple of guys got up in the front telling their stories, and there was a couple of guys there that they had held down. And I have never seen such apologies, such tears come out of these men. He said, "I'm so sorry. I've never forgiven myself for doing that." And, of course, they hugged and they said, "You know, what do you do? If you didn't do it, you got beaten too." So all of that was forgiven. But it was horrible to have to hold a boy down to be beaten like that. And I'm not talking about this leather strap they used was two pieces of quarter-inch leather with a piece of sheet metal in between to make it pretty stiff. And this thing actually weighed, I have a copy of it that we had made. It actually weighs more than a professional baseball bat.
Now, the men who have experienced this, these beatings and experienced this horrible abuse, this stayed with them for their lifetime, didn't it? It affected all of their relationships in the future, and they're still fearful even now. Some of them still having recurrent thoughts and even nightmares about the abuse.
Well, especially those who were molested, who were pulled out of their bed in the middle of the night, are still having problems dealing with that. The thing that I noticed that seems to be most prevalent with these men, and I know about between 400 and 500 of them that I've got together for these reunions, the biggest problem is they have trust issues, lack of trust. Most of them have been married 2, 3, 4 times. A bunch of them, a majority of them, have anger problems. And like I said, these were innocent kids who were just smoking cigarettes or skipping school or running away. I remember the day that we had the closing of the White House, and the governor's people was there, the governor of Florida. And the White House, I was at a podium, and the White House was less than 2, 3 feet behind me. And I pointed over my shoulder, and I said, "A lot of good little boys went into this White House. But let me tell you, a lot more little Charlie Mansons walked back out than good little boys that went in." And one guy actually from the governor's office dropped his coffee, because I think that was the most profound statement he probably ever heard about the damage done by those beatings in the White House. I mean, I worked at the hospital for almost a year, and I can't really give you an accurate number, but there was boys who came in, myself included, who were beaten. Their underwear had to be surgically removed from their buttocks. Some had stitches. They never got over that, ever.
And these were children, very young children. I mean, some of them were like 13 years old,
Nine and 10 years old, 11, 12. The majority of them were probably, I would say the majority of the 600 were anywhere from 12 to 16. But I cannot recall one person, not one out of the 600 when I was there, who was there for a violent crime like murder or anything like that. I think most of those have been sent off to the actual adult facility at that time. But nobody was there for a serious crime. There were a few there which we would consider a serious crime today, which was called joyriding, but it wasn't like, somebody jerks you out of your car, cuts your throat, takes your car today. It wasn't like that. You'd go down the street and you'd see a car with the keys or it's running. You jump in it and go get a couple of your buddies. You drive around for a while and then you just leave the car. You don't destroy it or anything else. It was just called joyriding. That was probably the worst crime that was committed by any of these boys.
Yeah, and seeking some kind of acknowledgement, reparation, and redress. The White House Boys organization that you founded came across some significant obstacles in trying to get acknowledgement of this problem, including when you tried to do a class action suit to the Circuit Court of the Sixth Judicial Circuit in Pinellas County in the state of Florida. You were basically told that you had to overcome barriers of statute of limitations, and that you had to somehow be capable of setting aside the sovereign immunity aspect of this, that basically the state can do anything, the law, and be sovereignly immune for it. So essentially the state of Florida for many years was assuming sovereign immunity for this horrible abuse because it was done in a facility that was funded by state funds.
Yeah, well, basically when we filed charges against the state of Florida, what we were filing for, there were two, at that time, two or three of the main beaters were still alive, the main one being Troy Tidwell, the one-armed man. And what we were after was to have him incarcerated. But because of the statute of limitations, you know, there's nothing that we could do about that. So that just sort of fell to the wayside. But right now we have, which, and I have to admit, this is not looking good. We have filed Senator Fazio of Florida has filed an action, a bill in the Florida Senate asking for some form of compensation for the men who are still surviving. And the lawyers that have taken over that case are the same lawyers that handled that big case, I can't remember the name of it now, for the blacks down in Florida when they took all their land, the Rosewood case. So they've taken over our case. But, again, compensation doesn't look likely because Florida itself is going in with a $2 billion deficit as, you know, as the next year comes in. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But the least Florida could do is to at least offer an apology. I think that would have settled most of the men down to at least when the FDLE report came out, they more or less tried to cover everything up. We're not saying it did happen. We're not saying it didn't happen. A bunch of these guys are older. They don't have all their facilities. They can't quite get their story straight and all this type of stuff. But what that boils down to, the state of Florida investigating itself would be like asking Charlie Manson to investigate whether they killed the LaBianca family. It was just totally absurd because Florida's main concern was to make sure that this wasn't found out so that there could be any legal civil recourse for the men. And so
now,
everything was just sort of left in the air.
How many children do you believe have passed through this facility in the 109 years it was in operation?
Well, I was there 1959, 1960. There were 600 there. So it runs into the thousands and thousands. But we have found that many of them, of course, died in Vietnam because they were put in the service after they came out of Mariana and Okeechobee. So they're still, just in Florida, we have about 400. I actually live in Georgia, Brunswick, Georgia. So there's still thousands of them out there that live all over the United States who have no idea that this action even occurred, you know, this legal or civil action.
If I can bring in the human rights international perspective here, I believe that one could clearly state that the abuse that the White House victims experienced is in excess of any normal punishment and would be considered cruel and degrading treatment and would most likely be considered a torture under the Convention Against Torture, which is international treaty. And I wanted to let all who might be listening know that there are no sovereign immunities for being a torturer under the Convention Against Torture, and that the U.S. government has signed and ratified that treaty, and that no one is immune, not even the President of the United States, not even the Secretary General of the United Nations. So a man who was abusing children at the Florida School for Boys would certainly not be immune from that statute, from that particular, from that particular treaty. And that under U.S. law and the treaties are the supreme law of the land, and any abuse of a child in this manner would be considered a violation of that treaty. And so I just wanted to let you know that that's our perspective here at Medical Whistleblower. We have 4 minutes remaining in our time. Roger, I'm sorry it's so short. We have much to talk about. I was hoping that you would tell people how they could get a hold of you if they wanted to support your efforts, your grassroots efforts to get acknowledgement of this problem for the White House survivors.
Right. We have a website, and it's called thewhitehouseboys.com. You have to put the in front of it, T-H-E, thewhitehouseboys.com. It's the website. It has my information there, my contact information, my address, phone number. It has all the men's stories there. One other point I would like to bring out that we find really absurd, when the courts ruled on this, the Pinellas County Court, we did find a law that said, was written some years back, probably in the early 1960s, middle 1960s, where they banned any type of flogging of the men in prison, men or women in prison. And when we brought this statute up, the court ruled that, well, it says men in prison. It doesn't say children. So they continued to flog and beat the children. And this is what I find absurd. There's a law that says you can't flog or beat men in prison. That would certainly include children, even though the wording may not be there. I mean, wouldn't you not beat a child before you would beat an adult? But that's one of the main causes that we lost on that particular case.
So I think it would be very clear to anyone who would look at this case that we did not protect the human rights under international law of the children that had been placed in this particular facility in Florida, and that the state of Florida did not abide by its obligation under international law to protect the children in this facility from human rights violations. And so I would like to encourage people to contact us here at the Medical Whistleblower. We can be reached through our Blog Talk Radio show. You can email us there. And we also have a website. Our website is Medical Whistleblower Network, no spaces, .jigsy.com, and you can see our efforts on human rights. I want to encourage a person to believe that they have been abused that White House to contact us, as we would like to help them in getting redress and reparations and acknowledgement of human rights violations at that facility. And I want to thank you for joining me, Roger, on this Blog Talk Radio show for Medical Whistleblower here in Lawrence, Kansas. And do you have any last minutes? We have 1 minute remaining.
Yeah, they can also reach me if they can't find the website, thewhitehouseboys.com. They can reach me through, they can into Google, they can Roger Kiser, R-O-G-E-R-K-I-S-E-R, no A in it, K-I-S-E-R, Roger Kiser, and they'll be able to find all my information there. All my stories, videos, books, all that will be there explaining what happened.
And we have several books out that explain this problem as well that will be listed on that website. I want to thank you very much for joining me, Roger. You've been a wonderful guest, and your story, of course, we would like to highlight again on our show. So I want to thank you for your wonderful work in human rights advocacy as a survivor advocate, and to support you fully here at Medical Whistleblower, and we are Human Rights Advocacy Network. And thank you again for coming. And everyone, please thank you for tuning in here to Medical Whistleblower. And please support our efforts by signing our petition on SINS.org to prevent child abuse. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Roger, for joining us.